Right, our next presenter is Andrew Henning from Milliman, and he'll be speaking on common author modelling pitfalls. Andrew is an actuary working in Milliman South Africa's non-life insurance team. He spent the majority of his career in non-life insurance consulting and helps his clients solve a variety of insurance-related problems. Andrew supports several non-life HAF appointments and consults to his clients on a variety of topics, including capital requirements, IFRS and SAM valuations, and ORSAs. Thank you, Andrew.
Hi, everyone. It's a huge privilege for me to be able to stand before you today and talk about ORSAs. You might recognize me if you don't know me. My photo is on the brochures in front of you. If you're looking at the photo and you think, well, I look better on the picture than on stage, I'm sorry, you're stuck with me for the next 45 minutes. So, first off, I want to ask you, if you think of the ORSA process and you think of what you're doing at ORSA, you look at the picture on the screen, do you feel like this person sitting on the left-hand side of the bus, or well, the way we're facing, or the person on the right-hand side? It's fair to say that many people do sometimes feel like they're sitting on the left-hand side of the bus. My purpose today is to try and get you to try and move over to this side of the bus where you can see we also can be a useful tool for you and just highlight some of our best practice that we've seen at Milliman globally and locally. A disclaimer, some of you might be already sitting here. Hopefully I can point out to you the nice trees and the nice things you haven't seen before. So let's dive into it. So why are we talking about ORSAs again? From our experience, we've seen that this is still a very troublesome and clunky process. Insurers still see it as a tick box exercise. It's still a process that keeps many people up at night. It's definitely not ideal. We have ever-changing and emerging risks. These are your cybersecurity risks, your climate risks, etc. The list goes on, and they keep on changing. We do have some changing regulations we need to consider. The latest one that's currently in draft, perhaps, is the monthly reporting on your liquidity positions. As I said, currently in draft. Maybe you can consider using your ORSA or using a similar method to report on that. We still see regular findings on our ORSAs, and too often it's a tick box exercise and really limited value for our clients and for everyone general. Again, sometimes. So today I'll be covering five topics. The first four that you'll see will be more our best practice, what we've seen, and just emerging good practice. The last one will be a bit of a deep dive. So if you feel that you're sitting on that right side of the bus, hopefully by come to number five, we might challenge your thinking a bit. So first topic, let's talk about base projections. So what we've seen is many times we take our base projections and our ORSAs as givens. This can be useful, this can work. However, how many times have we seen a very aggressive marketing department where they just think, well, we will be able to sell all these millions of policies? So linked with that, we've got these base scenarios. There are often very limited discussions around, well, what is the actual feasibility of what we're feeding into our models? Are they conservative? Are they aggressive? Are they best estimates? And kind of why do we feel it's appropriate to have these base scenarios in our ORSAs? And oftentimes, might be another department, someone else doing these projections, it might just be difficult to challenge and go to these people and say, well, I think you're not going to sell a million policies. I think it's closer to 100. So what do we do about this? Some things that we have seen people do that's emerging could be a good idea is to include your risk management function or include your actuaries in the discussions where these strategic sessions happen. This can be useful to get other people's views involved in the process of setting your base scenario of your base projections. And well, the question is then, well, now if we can't necessarily do this, well, or we are still stuck with it, well, why is this appropriate to include in our Orsha? So one thing that we can do at the end of the day, if we do have this projection as actuaries, we can consider adjusting the Orsha projections themselves as well. Furthermore, we typically have another issue that we deal with. These could be, well, the most common one that I've encountered personally and have seen is around the base projections being not granular enough for our use in our Orsha model. So you can think you get a high-level premium line figure that you need to replicate in your Orsha model, but while my Orsha model is using a frequency severity, the number of policies and the average premium per policy. So we find this issue where we have actuarial rigor that's in our actuarial model, but how do we reconcile it with our base projections that we receive from the finance department or wherever that might be? So the thing there that often happens is we do end up with these nonsensible assumptions in our drivers that we try and back solve and able to match these base projections. Now, how do we deal with these? Most ideal, what we've seen, is actually someone taking and using the Orsha model in the projections, or at least go and compare whatever you have or to use it as a soundboard in your projection setting. Now, using a good model will help you with this process. You will get a coherent, you will get a realistic projection out of it. Alternatively, you can discuss this at the setting of the projections when that's happening, if you get access to that department. Yes, overall, it will give you a better understanding of your targets and with the feasibility of what you're trying to and what you're trying to achieve. Ultimately, it also adds in value add. Your rest of your business will be able to tell, well, what is the key drivers, what do we need to market to in order to achieve our targets that we have. So, another topic. And now that we're done with the base projections, is around scenario design, selection, and modeling. Now, I guess for a lot of us, it's repeating some of the stuff we already know. But just to reiterate, some key thoughts that we do have is it's useful to keep some scenarios, some sensitivities and stresses consistent. Reason for that is you can actually see year on year how we change how our business is changing, and it's useful to see some key sensitivities, how our insurance company is reacting to that. What we have seen, though, is good to rotate scenarios. We often see people coming up with scenarios, keeping them the same under time pressures, recycling. It's good to rotate it, but the most challenging thing is around, well, how do we deal with these emerging and hot topics and other guidance that we find from our in the industry. So the key challenge that we've seen with this is incorrect parameterization of these scenarios. Now, admittedly, it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. Say, well, this is my top three-step method how to actually parameterize any scenario you want, from complex things like climate change, from cybersecurity, etc. But one thing that I do want to encourage you is when you have these scenario settings is to rather go and discuss and have these brainstorming sessions on the Orsha, on the scenarios. Because oftentimes it's open to judgment, but brainstorming and thinking about especially the second order impacts that happens after year one could be very useful. Also very good to think about the calibration of your scenarios. Useful to have a mix of them. Your business doesn't necessarily respond the same for all various scenarios. Advice, if you're starting out with this, rather go for high quality, well thought out, well brainstormed scenarios rather than and with low high quality and low quantity. I think a lot of this I've already spoken to. The one thing I would like to highlight, though, is one unpopular opinion that may or might be unpopular, but and might contradict what I just said, is around, well, you should be modeling more of your scenarios that actually ends up in your OSHA report. Now, ideally, if you're starting out and you have an immature process, try and get these, the first few. But as you progress, it is useful to have a range of them to be able to select from an array of scenarios in order to select what's more appropriate, what's most interesting, and what you find useful for your business. Some other things that I would also just like to bring to your attention, things like high-risk areas where we make changes in our models, anywhere where we have these hacks in our models, yeah, just good documentation. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but just some reminding. Another thing we've seen that more often happens than we might sometimes think is around how easy it is to get lost in translation. We've got independent teams doing work. We've got independent people from who's setting the scenarios and who's actually implementing this. You'll see that consider these three scenarios. Which of these two columns for each scenario would you consider appropriate? If I tell you a 30% increase in claims ratio, are we meaning an additive 30 or a multiplicative 30% increase? I guess the right answer could be it can be either. So it's just a reminder to be explicit when defining these. Model design and some of those considerations around that. So as we hear technology, as we all know, technology is changing. Computers are getting faster. We're getting fancier models. We also have a very, very good understanding of SAM now, since it's been around for a few years. So we can really, if we have to, build something that we really like. However, I'm not here today to advocate for very fast, powerful, fancy models. Our views are that typical issue that we have is not with model runtime, but it's probably more with human error, human time for people to do the work, the whole process around OSHA. So could be different for life, and they typically sit with more complexities, but for non-life, this is mainly what we've seen. So what I'm advocating for is an easy to update, not so easy to break model. This will help you with a faster turnaround time, making everything more useful and less painful at the end of the day. Now, again, this is a case-by-case basis that we need to approach this. Depends what you currently have. How do we approach it? How do we change it? But at the end of the day, it could be a balance between our parameters that we have in our model and the tweaks that we do in our model. Sufficient checks, controls to enable us to quickly see if something goes wrong. It's also very useful. Yeah, and again, modeling something at a sufficient granularity. There's no point in going too granular if you're modeling something that could be estimated by something simpler. Now, I do want to stand still around the topic of using proxies in a model. Now, proxies are great. They make the model faster. They make it less complex, and it's very easy to develop. You can simply take something and model your SER component. However, these often can break down under stress, can break down under more extreme scenarios, and it also reduces our flexibility of our model. It restricts what we can do with our model. So a simple example would be, what happens if we change a CQS level of an insurer on our portfolio? Or in our reinsurance program, if we change a CQS, you need to change an element of how the SCR is calculated. Can't simply do that when using proxies. Now, there are also some catch points when it comes to proxies that I do want to highlight. The first one is investment income. We've seen all three of these combinations of, well, people using investment income as a percentage of premium to project it, or investment income as a percentage of own funds or assets. Which one is more appropriate? I would I would strongly advocate for the assets, but we have seen different cases using the other two. On the non-life underwriting risk side, we use net or gross premium. Well, we have seen cases where it works very well, and it does typically work very well because it's so closely correlated with the underlying projections. However, oftentimes changing reinsurance structures and a lot of things can make this break down. For example, you have a growing certain piece of and part of your business that's growing. This can easily break down, especially under very aggressive new sales expectations. Similarly, with market risk as a percentage of own funds or assets, your asset mix can change. You can have impacts, things like your equity symmetric adjustment can change, your yield curves. So it might just be worth thinking about the use of proxies. So at the end of the day, could be you. I would encourage you to use the proxies and consider what is best that's driving your underlying risk, what you're trying to model. Split it by line of business, things like your premium or your market risk, consider splitting that out according to either the subcomponents that it consists of. And we'll touch on actual versus expected now, but it can also be useful to tell you how good your proxies are. And another thing, if you're using proxies, that's great. We can always consider testing them out of cycle when things aren't so busy and close to the deadlines. So I've mentioned we'll talk a bit about the actual versus expected. Now, the GOIs require you to compare your actual emerging experience with what you have in your OSHA report, or at least your previous OSHA reports. Now, for us, we've seen this is probably the least well-applied item that we have typically seen in our OSHA reports. Now, just want to highlight some of things that we do suggest to do this right. Number one would be using sufficient granularity. We often see, we compare these SCR with what we've projected last year, what we've projected now. Oh, so-and-so is up because we've got more premium, got more assets. But oftentimes combining different elements of the business, comparing different elements together, paints a better picture. Also, we often see people not comparing the projections themselves with meaning whatever we've projected in the past for future years compared to our latest projections for future time periods. So if I'm projecting for 2027, if I projected it last year, projected it now again, that is also useful to consider and use as a feedback loop back into making your OSHA more useful, making it more, adding more value to your business. That was more the basic good practice items that we've seen. I do want to take the opportunity to stand still at the concept of loss absorbing capacity of deferred taxes. Now, for me personally, this is what I immediately think when I see that. And the idea is oftentimes I think by myself, I'm the one at the end, and then all of a sudden there's some additional complexity that pops out of this calculation. There has been a lot of talk about it the last few years, few months. So I do want to highlight some of the considerations when you're performing your OSHA models, what to think about in this context. So just highlighting some of the background information. First off, we have basic own funds. This is your assets minus liabilities. And typical SCR shocks change of your basic own funds. So your start minus being basic own funds. You can do it either way around. It's just this way around to get a positive number. Your assets and liabilities includes deferred tax asset, deferred tax liability. It's just the difference between whatever basis you're looking at and your tax basis, whether or not you have the tax owed or taxes that SARS owes you of these projections, following these projections. Now, the concept of the lagged ET is that where you assume a stress event happen, but then you do have this offsetting impact for, well, now the stress events happen, you make a loss, but you actually pay less tax. So it has an offsetting impact, increasing your deferred tax asset or decreasing your existing DTL. Now, typically, from a modeling perspective, it's typically easy if you have an existing DTL and you have a loss event. A DTL, you can simply just reduce it, basically with your tax rate and based on the loss that you've suffered. However, I do want to urge you, more care needs to be given when we start raising our deferred tax assets. So, some of the basics, we have very limited guidance in the FSIs. In a LACTT context, we can only consider 3 years of profits when recovering our stress deferred tax asset. This is new, but not so new anymore. It's around, you can only use 80% of your taxable income to offset against previous assessed losses. So something to think about. It more delays the impact if you have enough profits than using your LACTT, but good impact. They don't have enough profits. And why is this so important? And why am I talking about this? So the lagged ET often can really have a big impact on your projected SCR. Typically, we've seen, it's up to a third where we can see this reduction. It's got significant judgment and no diversification. We take the heat straight to our SCR. Now, that's one side of the story. The other side is ultimately these tax rules are very complex. And the question is when we are struggling with these complex tax rules, are we the right people to be doing this work? Are we skilled enough to understand, well, what's all the tax implications and how will it impact our business? So when you're facing these questions, it might be useful to reach out to a tax professional in your insurance company. So ultimately, it's easy to overstate or understate your SCR. It's actually much easier to understate your SCR. There's more reasons to include LACTT than actually exclude it, so just be aware of that. There is a SR guidance information note available, though. It's drafted by the Life Assurance Committee. However, it does apply to non-life as well. It talks about a few concepts. The one is around tax funds, the assumptions of going concern, some considerations of post-stress profits, and management actions. So just as a basic, I'll focus on the first two. So what do we mean by the tax funds? So fortunately, it's less complicated for life, for non-life than it is for life. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's not complicated. So effectively, we sit with two funds. We've got tax that we pay for capital gains or losses, so tax pay or own, or you can have this DTA, DTL that's raised with respect to operational profits and losses. Now, the key item here to remember, and based on our limited knowledge, and remember, I'm not a tax expert, is that tax on capital losses are ring-fenced. So what does this mean for our projections? It means that operational income cannot be used to offset a deferred tax asset that's raised with respect to capital losses. And however, we can use capital gains to offset a DTA with respect to operational losses. So ultimately what this means is when we model a scenario where we have market loss, so you think about any 1 in 200 year scenario on your market risk module, this means that this DTA that you raise with respect to that is ring-fenced and you can only recover that with future expected gains in the market, or well, capital gains, and not from your operational income. I'll show a small example in the coming slides. The second item is around the going concern concept. The LAC DT calculation comes down to, well, we simulate this post-stress, but the question is, well, in order to calculate, to recover your deferred tax asset that you raise under this stress scenario, well, can you actually recover it if you're not a going concern? The question is no, you can't, because you're not a going concern anymore. So big question is, well, once we calculate this LAC DT or we simulate the stress and we say, well, do we have sufficient own funds to be able to meet our SCR and MCR cover? And if not, well, how long will it take? Now, working on an average of SCR cover of 1.7, 1.8 seen across the industry, it's very likely that, well, if this happens to a typical insurance company, non-life insurance company, you will probably sit with close to one, or if not under one, SCR at the end of the day. Now, and furthermore, well, now, and this maybe talks to more the post-stress projections. Now, if you do have this hit, now something bad has happened to your company. Everybody knows you, well, they know your SCR cover is under one. Will your brokers be comfortable with placing business still with you? Or are there other considerations that can impact even your post-stress profits? Because we can't necessarily assume things would be the same after such an event happens. So, again, talks about the subjectivity, and it's really, we should be careful about the assumptions that we make post-stress. So, just a simple example that we can show you here. Consider before a shock, so we've got 40 assets, 10 liabilities, own funds of 30. We do have own funds eligible to meet our SCR, and we've got an SCR minimum, say the minimum amount of 50 million, and we have an SCR cover of 2. Now the SCR event happens. So we take our other assets, so we split assets out by your DTA and other assets. This effectively reduces by 15 million because we assume this event happens. And now we see this reduction, we see this increase in the deferred tax asset, which we assume will happen because we just assume, for the example, that we are still going concern. But it's a bit of a chicken and the egg. But at the end of the day, when you do your calculation on the right-hand side, considering also that this might bring in issues with your Tier 3 capital, you might end up with an SCR cover of under 1. So it might be useful to think, well, will I be able to recover that? And will I be able to recover this amount from my future stress profits? If not, you simply can't allow for that, like that benefit of raising that deferred tax asset. So that's the basics. That's some background. Some of you might already be aware of some of these concepts. So, well, let's talk about the mistakes that we make when we model it in our OSA projections themselves. So, first off, so if we just think about our modeling and not yet of the LAC DT, so our base position will have either a DTA or DTL. Typically, what we've seen with these models, very little attention is given to it. It's a percentage of something, or it just changes with own funds, etc. Now, let's consider the scenario where adverse event happens. So now, we have this adverse scenario. So let's say we've got our base position, we've got the scenario that happens, and now we have a loss that occurs. This will mean that we should model an increase in our net deferred tax asset liability. So it could either mean we decrease our deferred tax liability. If there's not enough there, we need to start raising DTA. And ultimately, when we do this, we need to consider, well, is this DTA actually recoverable even before we consider our LAC DT calculation? So this is something that we often see is missing from these calculations. We could talk about that, well, under the base scenario, the PA guidance does talk about the three-year rule. Do we have the same rule that applies to what we have on our base projections and our base balance sheet? Well, there are a lot of reasons to still stick with the three-year rule. But yeah, just consider when you deviate from that, the appropriateness thereof, and talk to a tax expert. But essentially, just skipping slightly ahead, think about now we've modeled this. Now we've modeled this adverse scenario. We've raised our DTA. That DTA we can only raise because we have excess profits, able to recover it in the future. Well, now that even puts our lagged DT calculation under stress in that scenario, because we actually eat up in some of those profits that we need to eat up into the profits we later need to use to raise this lagged DT. But more on that in a little bit later. So the key concept I want to leave with you is be careful when you are raising DTAs on your ORSA projections. So I've just got three scenarios here to illustrate what we mean. So scenario one, least adverse. Let's consider we do have a large DTL on our liability on our balance sheet. We consider a loss scenario, so anything, big hailstorm. It could be a cyber attack. But we have a loss. This loss, in essence, reduces the existing DTL, but to such an extent that we don't need to raise any DTA. It just eats into it. This case is the easiest. We just reduce our DTL. Let's consider where it starts getting more gray. So now we have the similar scenario, but we have a small or zero DTL. So this means that when we have a loss, we actually need to raise this DTA. Okay. So this is where we start needing to take care of doing our deferred the test for our DTA that we have in our modeling. So this is the one case where what I'm talking about that gets a bit more involved. It can even be in such a scenario where the loss is so big and your post profits after this scenario that you're modeling is so under strain that you might end up with, well, there's actually no DTA that we can allow for under the scenario. So as you can see, there is a bit of consideration for this part that's often overlooked in our ORSA model. So just showing practically how this calculation works. How do we test for recoverability of our deferred tax asset? So let's consider the scenario. Let's forget about tax funds for now. I'll expand to that now. But the idea is we have a loss such that we need to raise a deferred tax asset of 15 million or reduce a liability or raise it. But in this case, we assume that we have, right before this event, we have a DTA of 5 million. So effectively, we need to raise a DTA of 20 million in our projections. That's the maximum we can do given the loss that we've suffered. Assuming the three-year rule, you can see here that we have profits. We apply the 80% rule as well that I've mentioned before. And we effectively end up with, well, given our profits, given the tax that we expect to pay on our future profits, we can only recover 16.3 million in this particular case. So in this case, your ORSA model should not use this 20 million and be able to cap it at that amount. Now, expanding on the idea of tax funds, just to put it in a practical example. So let's consider the same scenario. We have 15 million loss such that we raise a DTA of 15 million. We have a DTA of 5 million before the event. But let's imagine that this is now a capital loss. So we can say a stock market crash or any market risk related item where we lost capital gains here. So the basic punchline that I'm going to show you here is this is where you'll split out your profits by what is coming from operations. That means your premiums, your normal insurance operations, and what is capital gains. and essentially splitting these out and considering the tax that you need to get for both, keep in mind the recovery rate is not necessarily the same. You can see that if we split it out, we can only recover 9.2 and 7.8 respectively from the two different sources. So it further adds a complexity where, well, we actually need to, of this 50 million loss that we have from the capital side, we can only allow for the 7.8 of that, just because when we ring fence this profit on capital, this taxable income on capital gains, we only get the 7.8 million. I hope that makes sense. So let's talk a little bit about, when we model this LAC DT, so now we've got our scenario, well, now we need to consider, well, can we raise the LAC DT under this scenario as well? So if you think about it, we have a stress position that we are modeling a scenario where we're already in a more stressed position compared to the base. Now we need to model a further SCR hit on our balance sheet and to be able to consider, well, what's the size of this LAC DT that I can raise. Now, as I've mentioned before, it could be a case even that, well, in raising your DT in your model scenario you've been modeling, you've already used up some of the profit. So now that needs to be considered. Well, do you have enough profits after this event happening, remaining profits, to justify your DTA that you have at the moment, plus what you will expect to raise at a later stage? Just keep in mind this part. I've covered most of it. A simple example, starting with least adverse, moving to most adverse, we can have a scenario where, well, we raise a small DTA under the scenario. That's after the SCR hit has happened. Even then, the insurer is still a going concern. We still have enough excess profits we allow for our LAC DT. A middle ground would be, well, we still have this base DTA that we raise. After the SCR event happening, it's in question whether we'll be able to still remain a going concern. If we are not a going concern, means zero LAC DT. If we are, the question is, well, to what extent do we have profits remaining at the end of the day to be able to raise a further DTA under the stress scenario to raise this LAC DT? Now, this is maybe something that we've identified that's potentially a bit of a gremlin or a weird thing, the SCR calculation. We could have a scenario where if it could be so adverse that you can have under the stress scenario that if you have a DTA that you already raised after modeling your scenario, but now you assume another SCR shock, you can actually have a reduction of that DTA just because your profits aren't there anymore after the shock happens. Now, what could happen here is, well, you already start off with no LAC DT in the scenario because you're not a going concern. But the fact that you have reduced DTA means that your own funds actually reduce after the stress event. So the question there is, well, could you have a negative LAC DT? Can you have a LAC DT that actually increases your SCR? Well, fortunately, the FSIs do cap it at zero, but it might well be the case that if this happens, you might see this effect coming through. So, in summary, we've talked about the four items, the four best practice items that we've seen, and we did a small deep dive in LAC DT. I hope it gave you some insight on how to do your next OSHA a little bit better. And I just want to say thank you for listening. Thank you for bearing through me through the time here. And I'll open the floor now for any questions if you might have some.
Thanks so much for that, Andrew. Maybe just some thoughts about the appropriateness of the three-year cap from the guidance on raising, because that's SARS doesn't put a three-year cap on things. And doesn't this three-year cap actually just introduce a lot of making things a bit more complicated?
Well, the thing is, I think what's important is to have some form of rule. So I do know that if you work, again, I'm not a tax expert, but I am aware that we have cases where accountants, when they determine the recoverability of this DTA, they could use a view of more than 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, etc. I guess ultimately it's good, first off, to have a cap. I think also, given the high impact of this calculation, the high impact of this lack DT, it's also a good idea to try and be prudent, so rather less than more, as a start. And I think the rule, I think also maybe to expand on that as well, we have heard practicing accountants mentioning that they have also applied the three-year rule in the past. I guess I can't speak for what was the thinking, especially behind why it's three. But no, in summary, I think good to be prudent, rather avoid being too high, and rather have a rule than opening up for even further more judgment.
And we've got a question from online. It says, thanks for the great insights. It's a two-part question. So firstly, what's your advice for handling a situation where base scenarios are based on budgets and the budgets are historically different to the actual financials? And then the second part is, have you seen common industry adjustments or actions being done to deal with that situation?
Yes, okay. Great question. So the first one is, I think, I might have touched on this, but I think a good idea would be to have that as a feedback loop. So where we have these differences, we are not necessarily saying that, well, you'll always be 100% accurate with what kind of your projections. After all, we are predicting the future. I think you can start raising a question saying, well, is it really appropriate if you are, you know, by a factor out every single year, especially if you're consistently low. So if you're projecting one side of the coin the whole time and it's consistently significantly higher or lower, I think that should be considered. Sorry, and the second part of the question?
Was, have you seen some common industry adjustments or actions being done to deal with the situation?
So this is something where we have considered it, we have talked about it with clients. I think some cases we have suggested doing it. It's something we don't rarely see. However, it's something I do recommend doing, especially because at the end of the day, if you're using some scenario in your ORSHA that is not really the base and it's more aggressive, it's more opportunistic scenario, it's good to have an opportunistic scenario. But if you're starting off from having a high, very lucrative scenario, and basically your shocks or your stresses become the base scenario, I don't know if that's a good starting point from the value add from Porsche.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. Are there any other questions?